So this morning we start lesson 15 of our look into Proverbs. And for the astute observer, you may realize that last week was lesson 13. And so we're doing things a little differently this week. I had planned on addressing chapter 9 this week, and it's a shorter chapter. It's about half the length of, say, 8. It's only 18 verses. And my hope was that we would cover it. And since we haven't had much time for discussion of the ideas and symbols and metaphors in Proverbs, that we'd finish the class with some review material to summarize what we've learned. Because after this week, we will be looking at the miscellanies. That's what we're going to call the rest of the series until we get to chapter 30 and 31. Because the discourse Proverbs end in chapter 9. So we will cover chapter 9, but we're going to cover that in the sermon this morning instead of the class today. And so that's why we're on lesson 15. And I do want to address one topic with some detail about chapter 9 that we won't have time to this morning. But we haven't had much time for observations and questions and ideas that may have been percolating since we started this class. And that's what today is. It's a bit of a review. It's a bit of an informal quiz. And if you've been with us from the beginning, it should hopefully make sense. So let's start off then with the very first lesson that we looked at, and that was the definition of a proverb. Our working definition has been adapted from Dan Phillips' book, God's Wisdom in Proverbs, and that is, a proverb is a compressed statement of wisdom, artfully crafted to be striking, thought-provoking, memorable, and practical. So a proverb is a compressed statement of wisdom, artfully crafted to be striking, thought-provoking, memorable, and practical. Some of the characteristics that were further identified as being part of a proverb is that they are terse. Proverbs are not verbose. They're not historical narratives. They're a terse statement. Packed, that they are dense. They're often pithy. Certainly memorable. That would be one of its chief characteristics. Relevant, practical, comprehensible, and repeatable. So those are not the only characteristics of Proverbs, but those are some that we've found so far in the class to be there. And so I want to look at just a few of these and put you on the spot as we think about Proverbs being memorable. So there were different devices used to help the child, the student, learn Proverbs. And when I say the student or the child, Solomon is, of course, addressing the first 9 chapters to my son, generally. Sometimes it's to children in plural, but oftentimes it's that my son characteristic. So let me ask you, what we've covered so far, what proverb has, and you don't have to tell us where it's at exactly, but what proverb has struck you as being memorable? See, it's an interesting twist, isn't it? Because if one of the characteristics of proverbs is that they're memorable, but you can't remember any of the proverbs we've looked at, you got to wonder how accurate the characteristic is. But it's true, they are memorable.
Wisdom is lifting up their head to cry out to everybody.
Yes.
The personification of wisdom.
The personification of wisdom, that's right. Yep. And that happened several times. It'll happen again this morning. That's right. Dan?
Well, speaking of not forgetting them, how about bind them around your neck and take them with you? So,
bind them around your neck. That's excellent. Yeah. Fear the Lord's beginning of wisdom. That's right. Yeah. That's right. And what do we... Well, we'll address that in just a minute. So, anything else? What other memorable aspect of Proverbs is stuck with you, either as a quote of the proverb itself or the meaning of the proverb or the teaching of the proverb underneath it? You don't have to quote the proverb, but...
Yeah. Just one that goes along with the notion of binding them around your neck, but just listen. That's the word that was used often. My son, listen to the words of my mouth. Hear, understand, listen.
That's
listen,
right. Listen. Yeah. Strong emphasis on listening. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Sam?
It's just the contrast between, okay, here's the way of the evil, and here's its consequences, and then here's the righteous path, and those consequences are the end of those as well. It's like, hey, I'm the older person, I've experienced these, listen to me, here's what's going to happen. It's the contrast.
If there's really anything, if there's one thing that I could, that I'd like to impress, is that Proverbs is a book of contrasts. Now, we analyzed a few of them in their structure, the antithetical sort of Proverbs, and Logan just mentioned one, the fear of the Lord is this, but, who can finish that?
They despise wisdom.
But fools, that's right, they despise this wisdom, and they despise instruction. And so, the technique, and you'll see this more in chapter 10 on in the Miscellanies, where Solomon is contrasting two ideas. There's this idea, and then there's the opposite idea. And obviously, one is meant to be admirable, and one is meant to be refuted or abandoned. Any other memorable aspects of Proverbs as we go on?
I think the Proverbs about the sluggard are particularly memorable because of the word pictures.
That's right.
The lion outside, I will be killed in the streets, he says. Or he buries his hand in the dish, but is too lazy to bring it back to his mouth. To me,
that's beautiful, isn't it?
Very, very imaginative.
Right.
Words.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, a lot of word pictures. That's right. Those are especially helpful. What else has been memorable in the idea of a proverb? Anything else stood out? Or, we've heard about artfully crafted, which is one of the characteristics Phillips mentions, thought-provoking. Has there been a particularly thought-provoking one?
Just the bait, the picture of really understanding what's going on and not being like most would be that just see the bait and do not recognize the net. The net being it's not laid in the side of the bird. Want to pay attention to what's actually there.
Yeah, that's really well said. Yeah, that's good. Look for the bait, but more importantly, look for the net. Right? See the bait for what it is. All right, well, let's move on. We've got quite a number of slides here to look at this morning. So, who wrote the book of Proverbs? We spent some time in the opening with the defense that Solomon is the author of Proverbs. He is noted at the beginning of the book, but he's also noted in chapter 10 and in other places that he wrote it, and he had some help at the end. Does anyone remember who else? I'm thinking of two people in particular, but then there was something else that said Solomon did it, but some people helped him. Do you guys remember who wrote that series we did? You guys remember?
Somebody, right?
What's that?
I don't know.
Well, I didn't hear what you said.
Can I cheat?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah,
the son of Jacob.
Yeah. Does anyone remember the mistranslated word that Jerome did in describing him? Do you remember what he was called? Jerome really, really fumbled the ball. Called him the vomiter. You guys remember that? Yeah. That's right. And what did that person write? What did he contribute, Sam? What section?
Chapter 30.
Chapter 30, right? What about 31?
King Lemuel.
Yeah, Lemuel. Actually, he didn't.
The oracle that his mother taught him.
His mother. Those are his mother's proverbs. She said he faithfully was the scribe, but he did what mom told him to do. So he was a dutiful son. That's right. Why she's not mentioned and he is a topic for open discussion. But there's also this section, we'll see it in chapter 10 next week, that these also are the sayings of Solomon. But then later on, I think it's in chapter 25, the men of Hezekiah's day found more Proverbs of Solomon and bound them together in the book. And so they are clearly attributed to Solomon, but they weren't in the original sampling, came a little bit later. So they're still Solomon's Proverbs. So there's no reason not to see Solomon as the author of Proverbs. That's the takeaway from this. There are lots of technical details that people argue about, but I think at face value, we should see that Solomon wrote this, and we examined other parts of Scripture to show how he was qualified to write these things and what God had instructed him. And so I think God prepared Solomon for the book of Proverbs, and he in fact wrote them. And then we see in verses 2 through 6 of chapter 1, this is the great preface, this is the dedicatory of the book, this is what we're using, this is why he wrote the book, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. To understand a proverb and an enigma, the words of the wise and their riddles. So this is the great purpose behind Proverbs, is to help these individuals with this task, to know wisdom and instruction. And we find this repeated on a number of occasions, that Solomon refers back to the reason why he wrote the book, to give wisdom, instruction, understanding, and such. All right, Logan mentioned it earlier, but what we're describing as the great hinge of Proverbs, and I hope you don't weary of me referring back to this, we'll refer to it again today, but the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. That's very clearly set in the opening of the book in verse 7, that this and this alone is wisdom. This is the understanding. This is how we're to live our life. This is the great hinge. The whole book needs to be understood in light of this truth. It's mentioned on a number of occasions what the fear of the Lord is like. It's not mentioned just once and not mentioned again. It's mentioned on a number of occasions. Anyone remember what... It's not stated exactly the same way each time, but it is repeated. So can you guys think back what other ways was the fear of God depicted in the opening 8 chapters? We learned recently what one was like, and that... go ahead. Yeah, how else is the fear of the Lord depicted? To hate evil. That was another one, that's right. Yeah. That's right. We'll see another one in chapter 9. We'll see them throughout the book in the miscellanies, but we'll see another one this morning, and we'll see them at the end of the book. But it's clear the fear of the Lord, it's happened, I think, three different times. If you don't get the idea that the fear of the Lord is the important hinge, it really is the way to understand the whole book, then you're going to miss it. So, the fear of the Lord drives the content. It's the focal object of Proverbs, but it's not the chief metaphor that's used. Solomon has another metaphor that he uses, and I think you'll find this even in the Psalms. You'll find it in other places, but certainly, without question, the chief metaphor of the book of Proverbs is that of the way or the path. And the way and the path represents your life's course, the way you think, the actions you take, the priorities you make, and the allegiances you hold. Might contain other things, but it's certainly the chief metaphor for what represents the whole of your life and how you are living it. So way and path happen quite a bit. We see those a lot of places. And I'm taking some extra time here, and we're not going to look at each chapter with the same detail, but I want to take some extra time in chapter 1. So the value of education, of watchfulness and discernment to avoid ill-gotten gain, bloodshed and a disregard for God's law would be one way of summarizing chapter 1. And who are the chief teachers of an individual's life? Who are the God-ordained chief instructors for an individual?
Parents.
Mother and father, that's right. Mom and dad, they are the chief ways. So when Solomon describes what the purpose of the book is, and then he describes the great hinge, the fear of the Lord, what's the very next thing he sets in place as an authoritative way to view instruction?
Listen to the words of your father.
Listen to your father, listen to your mother. Obey what they are telling you, that's right. And those ideas of your father and your mother, they're repeated throughout these opening chapters. And in fact, one instance in particular that strikes me is he refers to the instruction, you know, listen to my commandments and listen to the law of your mother. And when he's referring to the law of the mother, he uses a different phrasing than he does for himself. And what he's instructing the children to understand is your mother is speaking God's law. He uses Torah. This is the law of your mother. Your mother is authorized. She's appointed by God to teach you God's law. So you can't, and he doesn't attribute that to himself. Now I think we can read into it. That's what he's doing. This is where the wisdom is coming from. But he's making an explicit declaration that mothers have an authority to teach their children God's law. It's not something reserved for the father alone. It's something that mothers can do. So verses 8 and 9 tell us who the teachers are, and it reveals to us what the curriculum is. It's God's law. And when we refer to God's law, what are the books that would have been available to Solomon to teach his children? I mean, he wouldn't have had Paul's letter to Timothy, right? Wouldn't have had the book of Revelation. So what books would he have had at his disposal to teach his children? The Pentateuch. And what is the Pentateuch?
Genesis.
That's right. Those first five books of the Bible. What else? What other parts?
Judges.
Judges, yeah. Judges would be another one.
Job.
Psalms, that's right. What else? Joshua. Yeah. What else? Yeah, we have Job. That's right. Think of a lady. No, not Esther. She comes later. Ruth. Somebody say Ruth. Yeah, Ruth. Right. Who would have been? What, great-great-grandmother or something like that of Solomon? Somewhere in that vicinity? Yeah. Anything else? I'm thinking of one book that was written, or two books written by the same man?
Samuel,
yeah. Oh, that's likely at his disposal. So there's a lot of things he doesn't have, right? I mean, a lot of things he doesn't have. And yet he describes this curriculum as being a rich source of information to instruct. Verses 10 to 19 help us to understand what the imparting of wisdom, how it originates in God's Word, and as Dan mentioned, it helps to connect the dots of life. God's Word and my experience and my observations tell me that this particular scenario is going to end badly. Don't do that. Don't go there. And then in verses 20 and 21, we see that a new voice is there on the scene to reinforce the message of God's law. It's no longer mom and dad, but wisdom, as Liz mentioned. Wisdom is speaking. And it's, I think, very reasonable to see Christ displayed in wisdom. This is poetical, it's tense, or it's terse, it's densely packed. We've got to be careful about how we extrapolate what Christ is doing, but it's reasonable to see Jesus here in wisdom. And toward the end, we see the messages and the warnings given to the scorner and the fool. Those are appropriate because as he closes his discourse, Proverbs, in chapter 9, he's referring to the scorner and the fool again. And he ends this section with a message given to us to remind us of what happens to them. Do you guys remember what happened to them? to the scorner and the fool? You guys remember when they mocked God's wisdom, and then wisdom did something to them at the end? You remember what wisdom was doing at the end? Laughing at them, that's right, yeah. So wisdom is saying, when you live a life of folly, when your end comes, I will mock you. I will laugh at you. And this is written as not only a warning to them, but it's a warning to us. It's instructional to us that wisdom rules the day. All right, so we started in chapter 2. There was, to my knowledge, the first of these literary devices, the chiasm, and there really is no end. This is an industry larger than I thought it would be of people who have identified chiasms. Looks like my arrows are out of order there. But so if you look at why did he do these things? Why did he write this way? Well, it's to make them memorable. It's to help make them stick. It shows the artistry involved with Solomon's composing of this work, that this is not a haphazard. It's not just pithy sayings. Solomon was crafting these instructions. And in this particular case, in 2:1, we find an ABBA chiastic structure that it's not worded this way in English, and it actually makes it quite difficult to spot these in English because the way the Hebrew worded them was different in word order and such. But my son, if you receive my words and my command you treasure within you, that's a paraphrase of the opening of 2:1. That's not how you'll read it in yours, but you can see the relationship here. If you receive what? My words and my commands. And my commands and my words are linked together. And if you receive and if you treasure, those are the structure in place to help the student remember these things. Unfortunately, that's largely lost in our English translations. Not completely, but it's really quite difficult at times to spot this. Unless you're putting forth a lot of effort. But there are chiasms. We haven't looked at many of them. I do want to look at one at the end of the class here that comes in Proverbs 9. But these structures do exist, and some of the literary devices that would have been patently visible to the student in Solomon's day are not visible to us with the same degree of clarity. In chapter 2, we find this idea of the if and thens of wisdom. If you receive my words and if you treasure my commands within you, then what do you get? You will understand the fear of Yahweh, right? And find the knowledge of God. So chapter 2 began with this if and then statement, these consequential statements to help understand where we're at. And what we get to the middle of chapter 2, we are we're forced to reckon with this idea that's very palpable throughout Proverbs, but it's not something that we think about. It's not the way we discuss things today. We put a finer point of division between folks who can understand something in their mind, but their life doesn't reflect it. Now, we might not agree with that, but that makes sense to us. That makes sense that they get it and they're not doing it. Sometimes it's a matter of ignorance, right? We look at the way a person's living their life and we say they might not know what to do, but other times they do know what to do and they're living their life in discord. And in Solomon's mind, you know, that distinction of really being able to understand something and having an understanding and not doing it, that wouldn't have made sense. He would say, if you know this, then it has to show up in your life. It has to be bearing fruit, or you don't really understand it the way it's being mentioned. You're operating at the realm of a rebel. So he would never ascribe virtue to understanding something but not seeing it worked out in your life. The two would have been very tightly knit together. And I think you see this even in some of the New Testament writers. Peter, I think, writes this way. For him, the idea that you would be justified, but you wouldn't be bearing fruit in sanctification, would strike him as, well, that's just stupid. Why would you think that? The very unified, organic way of approaching it. And Thomas Chalmers has this quote, which I think is really helpful, that the righteousness of our conduct contributes to the enlightenment of our creed. The righteousness of our conduct contributes to the enlightenment of our creed. And sometimes I think it's maybe a criticism of Reformed folks, broadly speaking, that we put an awful lot of effort into making sure we understand things, that we have our confessional standards set, that we understand our doctrine. We like being precise. There's virtue in being precise. You want precise people writing those things. But sometimes I think if there's ever a complaint that can be legitimately leveled against us, it's sometimes we value the precision more than the implementation. And Chalmers' quote here said, if you want your creed, if you want your statement of faith to be real and accurate and to be distinct, then let it appear in your conduct. And so Solomon is saying this precisely, and this is the object of chapter 2 here. He stores up sound wisdom from the upright, and what is he? He's a shield to those who walk uprightly. There's a connection here between what you're thinking and how you're living. So chapter 2 really addressed this. It's well worth remembering. If you want to be a smarter Christian, walk uprightly. Your creed develops with your walk. It's not to say the precision in others isn't important, but there it is. And in chapter 2, we end up meeting somebody. And, wow, she's a piece of work, isn't she? Do you remember her? It's the strange woman. And you guys, I mean, she's not strange, and that chick is just odd, right? No, I mean, why is that not the case? Why is it that she just is goofy? She's not goofy. That's not the problem, right? Solomon's not going to spend time warning about the goofy people you'll meet. I mean, our congregation would be decimated if we had to remove goofy people. I'm not going to ask you who you think those goofs are, but they're here, aren't they, right? So this isn't goofy. What is it about her? Why do we need to be warned about a strange woman? She doesn't belong to you. That's right, yeah. So there's a few other verses here in Numbers 3 that Nadab and Abihu, it was just a fire after all, right? I mean, but it was a strange fire. It wasn't the fire that God had appointed. And in Deuteronomy, this idea of foreign gods. Look, you provoked me with foreign gods. It's the same word here. It's the same strangeness. Strangers have risen up against me. Oppressors have sought my life in Psalm 54. The strange woman, she does not belong to you. She may not belong to anybody right now. It's not that she is always attached to someone else, but she doesn't belong to you. And that's the point to get, that she might be married and she might not be. We don't know her marital status. Now, in this case, we think that she probably is married. She forsakes the companion of her youth. I think this is Solomon's way of describing she is married. But it's a strange woman. And do we find strange women today? Do we have strange women in our town, in our lives today? Oh, you better believe we do. They're all over the place. Absolutely. Absolutely. Chapter 3 brought us to a different style. In chapter 2, we had a lot of the if and the thens, right? If you do this, then you will do that. But in chapter 3, he spends a lot of time telling us what not to do. Do not forget my law. Do not. Let not mercy and truth forsake you. Lean not. Do not do this. Do not do that. Do not detest this. And so one of the tools that Solomon is employing in this work of explaining to his son, parents, I'm sure, will be able to appreciate this, and I don't know how much the children will, who have been students, but as parents, you want to explain something to your kids, right? You tell them, but then you have this sense of dread that they're just going to forget it, right? You've told them, you've explained to them what to do, and then when you ask them about their behavior later, did you do this? Oh, what are they like? What is the response? Oh, I forgot. Well, just to show that human nature doesn't change, Solomon, in schooling his boys, my son, do not forget. It's one thing to be intellectually capable of receiving the truth and understanding it. The next step is to make sure that you keep it, that you don't let go of it. So that's what we saw in the opening of chapter 3 there. And we get more of, in chapter 3, this is, we find these do not do this and do not do that. And then he moves into this business about wealth, honoring God. And then he says something really odd in verse 11. Do not despise the chastening of the Lord. Right? I mean, he's telling them, you've got all these earthly goods, your vats will overflow, you honor the Lord, you understand the fear of the Lord, good things are going to happen. He's describing the richness and the vastness of the beauty of truth that has been given to him. But then he says, don't despise the chastening of the Lord or his correction. And this idea of whom the Lord corrects, or whom the Lord loves, he corrects as a father does the son. This quote from this work by Pottgier, I think, is really helpful in understanding 3. And it's really helpful in our being adopted into God's family. He summarizes it in these 5 ways. The father invites the son into a relationship with him by taking the father's instruction to heart. My son, don't forget these things. The relationship implies mutual trust and integrity that originates in a relationship of trust with Yahweh. I want you to trust me. I'm giving you Yahweh's words so that you will grow in your trust and understanding of Yahweh. But trusting in Yahweh in turn implies giving up forms of self-confidence. Do not lean into your own understanding. Put your trust in Him. Then the son will realize that all the blessings come from Yahweh alone, and he will honor Yahweh with all of his wealth. But then 5, the place where this comes together is he will allow Yahweh to become his teacher and father and will accept Yahweh's discipline as necessary for his own personal growth. See, that's the final step. It's delivering all this instruction, pointing this child to follow Yahweh to the point where he recognizes that Yahweh is really his father. Yahweh is the one who is holding him. And so his summary is this poem concludes us a full circle, the process beginning with the human father reaching its true purpose and zenith when Yahweh becomes the real teacher and father. And as a parent, this is exactly what you want for your kids. You want for your kids to understand that they belong to God and that He is their instructor, He's their father. So chapter 3 really helps us to see the beauty of this relationship of earthly father drawing his son into the relationship of Yahweh. So I'll stop there for a minute. We're turning this into a monologue, actually. That was a euphemism. I'm turning it into a monologue. But any comments or questions here? Okay, well, let's...
I have one, Dave.
Yep, go ahead.
I appreciate what you said about the risk of being really precise in our creed and a little lax in our maybe implementation of that. I couldn't help but think of maybe we have a, especially in Reformed circles, maybe we have a fantastic statement of faith, you know, and all our doctrine really worked out, and we have 75,000 minutes of it on our website or something like that. It's all great. All this great stuff is good, but then let's say there's a person in the ditch that's been beat up and robbed, is poor and needy or something, and we construct great teaching about what ought to be done for this person and do all these things to talk about it later when they get to the synagogue, and meanwhile we did nothing.
Right.
And here comes somebody who's got a less precise and have errors and issues with their profession of faith, who's didn't make it to our seminar because they were at the hospital getting situated and paying for all this care.
Yeah.
So that, you know, you're just thinking about, it's easy to look at the Pharisees and all these and say, yeah, look at them walking on the other side. Who's the neighbor to him? But that command right there, Jesus is so clear that it's the care for those kinds of people that's so important. So anyway, just...
It is. That's
what you said was good to think about. We have to be able to put the two together and make sure that we're not majoring in
only
precision.
Right. It reminds me how easy it is to be like the disciples when they pass the man who was born blind. And so they didn't ask Jesus, would you heal him? They asked him, who sinned? This man or his parents? They were looking for the precision to find what was causing the problem. But the man himself was just an object lesson. He didn't have a soul. He wasn't somebody who had suffered for years. You know, and Jesus takes and heals him and corrects him. So I think the tendency is there to forget the value of the people we encounter.
How about the Pharisees getting so angry for him healing on the Sabbath day?
Right.
Here's this man who's just been healed from a lifetime of several different ailments.
Right.
It was on the Sabbath day.
It was on the Sabbath. Only by way of reminder, Solomon introduces this idea of happiness and blessedness, the only true happiness and blessedness you'll find in the latter part of chapter 3. And we don't have enough time to go into these details, so just here to jog your memory. And then at the end of chapter 3, we see Solomon showing that true wisdom loves your neighbor. Do not withhold good. Do not say to your neighbor, do not devise evil, do not strive, and do not envy. That God is acutely aware of not only where you're at in life, but who are the people around you. And wisdom loves her neighbors. We find in chapter 4 that the way and the path become prominent in this discussion. I've highlighted the areas here from 11 to 19. You walk in the way of wisdom, the right path. When you run in the path, when you do not enter the path of the wicked, do not avoid it, do not travel on it. The way and path, way and path, way and path. I want you to think about what it means when you encounter the idea of your way and your path, because it's a metaphor that will not shake loose from these discourse proverbs. The whole body is involved in the acquisition and preservation of wisdom. Incline your ear, your eyes, your heart, your flesh, your heart again, your mouth, your lips, your eyes, your eyelids, your feet, the right and the left hand and your foot from evil. That Solomon is employing these very concrete objects about you to help you understand how to live the Christian life. Incline your ear. It's one of the points Dan has mentioned. He wants you to think of that leaning, that tilting, so that you can hear. These words never depart from your eyes. Always have them. Well, I mean, you would be functionless in society, right? If they were literally right in front of your eyes all the time, you wouldn't be able to see anything around you. You go bump in the night and in the day. But Solomon is making this point that God's law needs to be near you. Wisdom involves the whole body. So here we meet this immoral woman in chapter 5. And one of the interesting things about the immoral woman is Solomon is instructing who? His son, my son. That he describes this woman in all of her allure. He doesn't tell him, well, she's not pretty or she's not attractive. In fact, he goes the opposite direction and said, you're not going to be able to withstand her allurements. You need to know about these allurements. They're coming your way. And how are you going to deal with these things? The lips, her lips, they drip honey. Her mouth is smoother than oil. So Solomon is very clear in his instruction for his son on what this woman is like in chapter 5. There's all kinds of warnings about her. But it's not just, say, avoid her. She's a bad woman. She is a bad woman. She's a strange woman. She doesn't belong to you. But more importantly, what God has in mind for you is so much better than what you have in mind or what she has in mind with this strange woman. So we looked at these metaphors of the water here in chapter 5. Drink water from your own cistern. What's the water a metaphor for? I spent a fair amount of time defending this idea, but I think it's theirs. But what's the metaphor of water in the middle of chapter 5 for? What are we to think of? Well, your own wife, that's true, but what is it about your own wife? Solomon's talking to his teenage son, or his... Yeah, the physical intimacy, that's right, that belongs to a married couple. And Solomon is telling his son, the allure of this woman is powerful, she's going to draw you in, but I'm telling you that what God has in mind for physical intimacy is mountains better than what you're going to get from this woman. And we close in chapter 5 with this somber thought of God pondering all of your paths. It's interesting, isn't it? To think of God seeing your life's course before His eyes at all times. In chapter 6, it was mentioned earlier about surety, the sluggard, the wicked man. We have a summary of these traits of avoiding ruin is one way of characterizing it. Avoiding improvident living by pledging your name, your wealth, your labor, and your future to others. That's the warning against surety. The sluggard, being overcome by poverty through indolence. The wicked man, avoid sudden calamity through maliciousness toward your neighbor. And then we find that the profile of this wicked man, in verse, there were, I think, seven items listed. He has a perverse mouth. And then it's in verse 12, but in verse 17 we see it's a proud look, and some commentators have observed a tight symmetry to what Jesus says in Matthew 5, relating back to these sections in Proverbs here. And then at the end, adultery, avoid strange and married women. Adultery will burn you without mercy. And that was that imagery. Can you take fire into your bosom? And the double entendre meant by that. In verse 7, we find out what is it that wisdom sees? Where is wisdom in Proverbs 7? Do you remember where wisdom's at? What's she doing? What's that?
Looking out a window.
Yeah, she's looking out a window. What's she looking at? What is she seeing?
Simple fools.
She's seeing the simple. That's right. I look through the lattice, right? She's up in a window looking down upon the city, and she sees the simple who are out and about. And she spied one among the simple, right? That was the idea. And she tells the story of what happens from this top view looking down. And what happens to the young man? What happens to him?
He's shot.
He dies a slow, painful death, right? Shot through a dart in the what? And we, the one commentator was telling us about liver disease, right? The seed of passion. We could see it in Caleb's eyes before he got married. He was liver sick, right? That was what the guy said. He was liver sick. Caleb was liver sick. I assured Rebecca it wasn't fatal. He'll be all right. But he was liver sick. Yeah, back in August. He's probably still liver sick. But this idea of him being seduced and brought to ruin as the ox that was led to the slaughter. And Solomon, again through this picturesque way, treat God's law as the apple of your eye. Beautiful and tender. To hold it close to you. And so this guy, he ends up dying. But in chapter 8, things turn completely, right? Chapter 8, we found wisdom was looking at this guy and seeing his ruin. But in chapter 8, we find the beauty of wisdom. Here, you can't help but be enraptured, which is one of the words that he's using, intoxicated with delight, back in chapter 5. And when you get to chapter 8, it's being intoxicated with the beauty of wisdom, that she's crying, that she asserts, look, I'm more valuable than silver, gold, rubies. Everything you can desire. It's the second time she uses that idea. Everything you can desire cannot be compared with the beauty of wisdom. And Jonathan mentioned that how the fear of the Lord hates, and we found the five things that the fear of God hates. But there's also something wisdom loves, right? What is it? I love those who love me, right? There's a tight relationship there with wisdom and love. So we find wisdom in all her creative glory, in the foundations of the earth and clouds, fountains, the seas, all of her work. And then at the end, when you find life and obtain favor, you do so with your relationship with me. And we see how this points in wonderful ways to Jesus. And we looked just briefly that this was one of the texts the Arians wanted to use to justify their idea that Jesus was not the same in substance with the Father. He was a good guy, but not who we think he is, and how that didn't hold true. And then in chapter 9, we're going to look at here in just a few minutes of the tale of two feasts, and we'll cover that in just a moment. So we're at the end of this lesson, but I want to point one thing to you about chapter 9 that we won't look at this morning, and that is this chiastic structure that I want you to, when we go through it in the sermon, I want you to have this to think about later. We can't do that early later today. But in verses 7 to 12, we find this structure ABCBA, and we find in 7 the scoffer getting shame for himself, and he's harming himself. But then that includes 7 and 8 verses. And then 9, this man, the wise man, what does he do? He increases in learning, which corresponds to the blessing given to the wise whose days are multiplied and years are added. We find that you'll bear your punishment alone at the end of verse 12, linking us back to the person who's getting shame, this literary device. But it's all focused on what? The fear of the Lord being the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. So the fear of God is the great hinge of the book of Proverbs. And your ways and your paths are the metaphor for understanding the course of your life. So next week we'll start the miscellanies, and if you remember, we're not going to discuss chapter 10, then chapter 11. We're going to take from 10 all the way through 29 topically. So we'll be jumping around in Proverbs by subject matter. I have a list of a few items. If there was something that you wanted me to discuss, we can do that. Just send me some email, let me know, and we'll be happy to plug that in if we can. We're running a little late. Any questions or comments about this review? Okay, well, let's pray.